Welcome to everyone who's here. That's really great that you've come along. So some of you have met me before. I'm Marguerite Daniel, and I'm a professor at the Department of Health Promotion and Development. And recently, a lot of my research has been to do with migrants, and in particular, refugees. And I've also been working with Fungi, who's my co-host. So Fungi, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Fungi Gwanzura-Otamola, and I work with Marguerite, basically the same department, and also doing the same research. We're on the same research projects, doing research with refugees who are settling in Norway. So we're focusing on the settlement phase, and I work in health promotion.
Thanks, Fungi. And as we're such a small group, let's have a round of introductions. So, Gesine, do you want to say a little bit more about yourself?
I'm currently a student at the University of Amsterdam in medical anthropology and sociology, but it's my second master. I did a master in public health and health promotion before in Indonesia, actually. So it's a bit of, and in between I worked in humanitarian with Doctors Without Borders, or on mainly as a health promotion, they call it health promotion, information education counseling manager or something like that. They have a very long name for that.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you. And Naxni, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello everyone. Can you hear
Hello.
me?
Yes.
So my name is Nancy. Nancy, you can call me Nancy.
Okay.
So I'm currently and I'm working as a postdoc at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. So I finished my PhD like in this January in from University of Alberta in Canada. So my research is on leisure and well-being actually. So and the SOC concept is very new to me, and this is also my first time like attending this conference as well as this workshop. So I'm very looking forward to hear about all your research and everybody's joining everybody's conversation.
Good. Thank you very much, Nancy. And Sally, do you hear us? Hello, Sally. No response there. Okay. Well, let's continue. So again, Fungi and I have together written a chapter that, oh wait, before we even get there, let me talk about what we want to do in this workshop. Yes, so we really want to think about how salutogenesis can make a difference in the life of migrants and host communities. And really, that's throughout today's workshop. And again, we're going to be doing work. We're going to be really thinking about it and sharing experiences and so on. But we want to think, how can our research make a difference? And in practice, how can salutogenesis make a difference in for migrants and in host communities? So that's our sort of overall aim for this workshop. And then sort of more specifically, what we're going to do, we're going to briefly summarize a chapter that we've written together, Fungi and myself. And then we're going to look at two particular case studies that emerged from that chapter, all the reading that we had to do, because we just think they're so interesting and they sort of exemplify things that we want to talk about further. So the one case study is very much about research, and the other case study is an evaluation of practice, and both use the sense of coherence, both use the three components of the sense of coherence in doing this. So then we won't go into breakout rooms, seeing we're so few. We'll do it all together, but we'll have a discussion about these two aspects, really comparing our own research and our own experience and how that fits in. And then we'll sum up in the end. As we all just one group, we don't need to come back to the main thing to do that. So first of all, then, this is the chapter that Fungi and I have written. It's just as simple as that, salutogenesis and migration. And we did a scoping review of all the literature that has been written about salutogenesis and migration since the turn of the century, so since 2000. It is forthcoming in the Handbook of Salutogenesis, the second edition, and unfortunately that's been delayed, but we're hoping that it'll be out by the end of the year still. So from all these articles, we collected all these different articles, and we had approximately 75 in the end, or 78. And what we did was we analyzed them in this way. We first of all separated the articles that were about voluntary migrants from those that were about forced migrants. And we define voluntary migrants as those who choose to travel to a different part of their own country, that would be internal, or to a different country in order to find work or for education or for other reasons. But the, most of the articles were about those two reasons. And then the forced migrants who are being forced, who may be being forced to leave because of geographical reasons or you know, like climate change or something, but most often it's through conflict and violence that they experience. And internally, they made, when they move internally, they're called internally displaced people. And so IDPs is the shortened form of that, but they most often move to different countries, and then it's external migration. We also looked at the research methods that were used, quantitative, qualitative, or mixed method. And I'll say something about that in our findings in the next slide. And then what we did was we very carefully analyzed what aspect of salutogenesis did the article use. So was it using the salutogenic model of health and its components, which are generalized resistance resources, or SOCs, sense of coherence, and its component parts, comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness? Or did they just use a broader, what we've called the salutogenic approach, where basically they just looked at what resources could help deal with particular stresses? So they were just looking at it in terms of resources and stresses, and they may have mentioned salutogenesis, but they weren't necessarily using particular components of the salutogenic model of health. So what did we find? Well, quantitative studies dominate in both the big sections of voluntary migrancy and involuntary, or you know, enforced migration. And very interestingly, the vast majority of the quantitative studies have a pathogenic focus. So even though they're mentioning something about, you know, they'll say we've used the SOC 13 or we've used the SOC 29, but what they're really looking at is anxiety, depression, PTSD. They're focusing on an illness. They're not focusing on well-being and health and so on. And we found that contradictory, really. We were rather surprised, to say the least. Qualitative research is much more able to deal with complexity, and it more often focuses on salutary factors. And we also found this to be the case with more recent studies. So since the 2015 refugee crisis, and note that I've put that in inverted commas, since then, there's been a lot more studies, and many of these are now much more salutogenic in approach, looking at what causes health, as opposed to what causes a particular disease, and including some of the quantitative studies. We also found really interesting that different studies used salutogenesis in very innovative ways. And this was very exciting to read about. And this is, in fact, what we would like to share with you later on in a bit more detail. So for example, some studies were looking at how do cultural values from the country of origin, how are those seen as being generalized resistance resources in the host country, in the new host country, and practices that they brought with them? Schools were seen as salutogenic arenas. So this is an opportunity. Schools were seen as an opportunity for really encouraging moves towards well-being, as opposed to, looking at what's going wrong with the children. And then, another interesting one, and Fungi is going to talk about this article, was the fact that expectations can enhance sense of coherence. So people who could adjust their expectations to reality seem to have a much higher sense of coherence than those who came with fixed expectations and stuck with those expectations. And then we also found some very holistic approaches. And just one example was horticultural training in eco-villages for refugee integration and healing. And this was a study in Denmark, and the refugees had been, were severely traumatized. They had witnessed awful things. And they found that this was incredibly healing for them to be involved in an eco-village context. So doing something completely different, not therapy, but, you know, working with plants out in nature in an eco-village, treated with respect and as equals, participation and treated as equals. It was very, very effective. So that, I mean, that's really all I'm going to say about our chapter. And what we want to do now is to really highlight, just using two different case studies, and Fungi is going to present the first one. And this is about voluntary migrants. So they migrated for labor reasons in the Netherlands, and it's using salutogenic model of health research. And the second one, I'm going to look at much more salutogenic approach, but it's evaluating practice. So Fungi is looking at a research approach. I'm going to look at a evaluation of practice. Fungi is looking at voluntary migrants. I'm going to look at forced migrants. So trying to give you a bit of a scope just through two articles. So over to you, Fungi. You're muted, yeah.
Sorry. So the article that I'm going to present is by Sluchis, Koetzenkamp, and Sahaso, The Mechanisms Behind the Formation of a Strong Sense of Coherence, the Role of Migration and Integration. And in this article, what they aim to do was to examine the mechanisms behind the formation of a strong sense of coherence and the role that migration and integration, as well as generalized resistance resources, played in this. And by the mechanisms, they were looking at things like consistency, load balance, and decision-making power in socially valued contexts. And I'll say a little bit about this more later. And then they were looking at what GRRs, were being used in this process. And this research that was done with immigrant women, and they focused on women, and these were voluntary immigrants, as Marguerite said, and they focused on women because they found that women are more likely to be, had more problems with getting employment. Having moved to, this was in the Netherlands, having moved to the Netherlands, the women had more problems getting employment. And the sample of women that they talked to were that women that had health problems. And they also say that women had more health problems. These were things like neck and back and shoulder pain, and also I think headaches. So this was a group that had some kind of symptoms that they focused on. So the sample was 46 first and second generation, because they kind of had the idea that there should be a difference between first generation, experiences of first generation and second generation migrant immigrant women. And they were from Morocco, Turkey, Suriname, age between 26 and 55. And I think the median age was about 39. Many of them apparently had low education or lower education, with only half of them having secondary school education. The method that they used, now this was part of a larger study, so the data was from a much bigger study where they had actually used the 13-item orientation of life questionnaire to measure sense of coherence. So they had the had the results from that, and then they also did, so it was mixed method, they also did life interviews with these women. And these interviews were where they talked about, you know, their life and their migration and integration experiences. Sort of in detail, so that was more in depth. So they could look at, okay, you have this sense of coherence, and we've measured, is it high, is it low, and then what are the experiences, and then see what influences what. So they were divided into two groups: strong and weak sense of coherence groups. Thanks, Marguerite. So findings. So what did they find? So they found that the women that had a weak sense of coherence measure. They had this issue of, they had these experiences before they migrated, because of course these were voluntary migrants. So they had an expectation that when I move to the Netherlands, I'm going to find a job and life is going to be like this and like that. And their post-migration reality was completely different. So for example, one woman had been working in hotels. She could speak several languages. She had all these skills. But when she got to the Netherlands, she couldn't get a job. So there was this frustration that, why do I have this experience? Why do I have this education? And why can I not make, you know, a life here? Why am I not moving forward? And that led to a weak sense of coherence, because she could not get over this expectation, and she could not change her expectations. The other one, which again is similar to this, was devaluation of country of origin specific resources. So again, having specific skills, and then these skills actually don't really mean anything, or you cannot transfer them. So for example, you may have languages that were very good in your country, but when you come to the Netherlands, these languages are of no use whatsoever. The other one, this was more towards the second generation. So these were the first generation migrants. The second generation migrants experienced what were called threats to identity and belonging. And this is when, of course, they had come to the country either as young people or were born there, but then they ended up with identifying with the majority population, and then, but having a clash between their sort of parents. So this is where I come from. This is my culture. And then the new home, the Dutch culture, and trying to fit in between those two. And that actually caused a low sense of coherence, which you'd think it would be the opposite, right? That they come in, they get into the society, they're young, and they pick up all the Dutch culture and everything, and everything is much better for them than the ones that came, the first generation. But it actually worked as a problem, being stuck between two cultures. Those with a strong sense of coherence, they had pre-migration experiences which met their post-migration experiences. And this meant, for example, I think it was Suriname, where they already spoke Dutch. So it was, when they came to, and they knew about the Netherlands, and they'd been told a lot about the Netherlands because it's a colony or former colony. So what they expected was, in a way, what they found. And then there were those that had, there was transferability and a quick development of resources, where, for them, for those who had the Dutch language, again, giving that example, it was easy for them to then just kind of flow into the Dutch society because they already had the language and maybe get into jobs. So they could quickly adjust and adapt because there was some familiarity in this new environment. And then the role of GRRs was also important for developing a strong sense of coherence. So for example, there were some that came in without the language and without knowledge of the Dutch environment, but because they had in-laws that helped them, helped interpret the society for them and gave them that social support and went to lessons with them and helped them practice their Dutch, that really helped. Others used religion as a generalized resistance resource, where because they believe that, okay, I'm a Muslim woman, and as Muslims, we are good people. So therefore, I'm going to behave in a certain way, and I'm going to contribute to society. That helped to strengthen them and help them to move forward in the new society. And then there was the narrative of being strong women. Because of where I come from, we are strong women. We can overcome. We have overcome challenges, and we can overcome the challenges that we face. So the challenges were there, but because of the narrative that they had, and this was like a collective narrative of being strong women from a specific country, and they carried that forward, and that helped to develop or to maintain a strong sense of coherence. So that's really just a very quick summary of that. So the conclusion was that there's a lack of conceptual distinction between the mechanisms that shape sense of coherence. So for example, consistency was supposed to be linked to comprehensibility. Manageability is supposed to be related to load balance. So for example, with consistency, right, if you find that the environment that you're in is consistent, it makes sense to you, then of course it'd be comprehensible. With the issue of manageability, if you find that, you have a good load balance, you can manage the load balance, you can manage the stresses or the strains that you're having to face, then that ended up with you being able to manage, feeling that, yes, I can manage this new environment. And with meaningfulness, and this was one that was a little bit more complicated, is decision-making power in a socially valued context. And they found that this didn't seem to be such a big deal. There were other things that were more important than decision-making power. And this was linked to meaningfulness. So it wasn't necessarily, according to Antonovsky, decision-making power is linked to meaningfulness, but Slutsch et al. didn't find this necessarily with this group of immigrant women. So that could be something that is different for migrants. And they also then, so they felt that this needs to be worked more on, that there's more work to be done here to see how these mechanisms shape the sense of coherence. And they also highlighted the need for attention towards women who came from high socioeconomic background. So women who had belonged in a high socioeconomic background in their home country seemed to struggle more when they came to the Netherlands. So you would expect that it's going to be easier with you have the education, you have work experience, but then it's more difficult for you to change your expectations because, as I said earlier, you have a certain expectation because of who you are and where you come from, and you're expecting things to be the same or easier for you in a new environment. But this actually did not work out this way, and they found it hard to adjust. And also the issue of second generation women, where there's an assumption that it's going to be easier for them because they've been born within this society, or at least have come in as youngsters and have been schooled within this environment. But this, what they call the integration paradox, is that although you're well integrated in many ways, you still are caught in between two cultures, and managing to sort of negotiate and navigate this was actually a challenge. Because one of the things that one of them said was that I can't quite be myself with my Dutch friends. When they see me, they have an expectation that I'm going to behave in a certain way because I come from this group, I come from this culture. So there's kind of a resentment for their culture, but then also an identifying with their culture. So you could really see the struggle. So there is that integration paradox, which I think is really interesting. And so they thought that these are things that need to be looked at when we're doing interventions, but also to look at the things that strengthen women. For example, these narratives of being strong women, and how can we, and religion and social support, and how can these also be used in interventions to further strengthen sense of coherence. So that's study in a nutshell.
Yeah, thank you, Fungi. And I mean, I think another thing that you've mentioned it here, but that I just think is so interesting, that research, where you're really listening to what the people are saying, can actually contribute to changing the theory. Because what she's really doing is she's saying, we need to go further than Antonovsky went. He said, these are the things that influence comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness, but there are other things. Yeah. And I think, you know, although the sense of coherence, SOC 13 and 29, have been tested in multiple different cultures and they supposedly work, but I still think perhaps we need to look for these other things, like that it's not so important to be involved in the decision making. Other things are more important to meaningfulness.
Yeah.
So I think as far as research goes, we need to really rethink how we do research so that it can benefit the groups that we're working with, these refugee groups. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this study by Reimer, and it's titled, Here It's Like You Don't Have to Leave the Classroom to Solve a Problem: How Restorative Justice in Schools Contributes to Students' Individual and Collective Sense of Coherence. And it takes place in a Canadian school. In fact, Nancy, it takes place in Alberta. So same place where you are, or where you did your PhD. And what they mean by restorative justice is that instead of having punitive justice when children break rules, that they get punished for breaking a rule, they think that it's much more important to actually restore a relationship. So they're looking much more at when relationships are violated rather than when rules and regulations are broken. And, you know, it's fundamentally about building, maintaining, and repairing relationships. And of course, for refugees trying to integrate, this thing of relationships with the host population is extremely important. So the larger study, again, it's just one part of a study. The larger study included a Canadian school and a Scottish school, both of which were saying that they would practice restorative justice. And what the researcher noticed was that in this Canadian school, they talked about this cohesion and cohesiveness, coherence a lot more. The kids, and these are primary school kids, okay, were talking like that. And she was intrigued. And so she went and she did further qualitative research in the Canadian school. And she only discovered sense of coherence afterwards and realized that actually this was something that could really explain it. So she did a sort of deductive analysis or evaluation of the coherence that she found in this Canadian school. So a small primary school, 350 students, and at least one third of the children there were refugees and immigrants. And they came from 40 different home countries. Some of them had never ever been to formal school. Some had had incredibly traumatizing experiences before arriving in Canada. And all of them, including the Canadian, the ethnic Canadians, had high levels of poverty. So it was in a poor area. And then she describes, she does a little bit more on what restorative justice is. And the idea, I'm just going to actually read a little bit. So when an incident happens, but they also use different methods to prevent things happening or to build relationships rather than, you know, just preventing it when it's broken. So if something happens, they will have what they call a restorative conversation. And this is what they will ask: what happened? What were you thinking about? Not what did you do? What were you thinking about? Okay. Who has been affected? And what needs to happen to make it right? So you can see there's no punitive question there. You know, why did you do that bad thing? It's not there. This is all about relationships. And when they talk about restorative circles, I mean, and I've heard about these being used in the UK as well, where they talk about circle time in schools. So it's not just the fact that you sit in a circle and everybody's facing each other, but they teach kids to listen, okay? And that relationships are, oh, excuse me, I'm getting a Teams call. Sorry. So it's not just about the, you know, facing each other and so on, but it's the kind of things that they're teaching the children to do. And the researcher, it's very interesting because she said she really noticed this in the behavior of the kids. She used a lot of co-researchers amongst these 10 to 12 year old children. And when she had them as a group and they were telling her about their school, you know, they would build on what each other had said. So one would say, yes, as Lily said, or as this one said, I agree, and this and this and this happens, or I actually think about it differently, I saw it like this. But they had really listened to what each other, what the others say, and that's something that they learned over time. It's not something you can develop instantly. So when she was now presenting her findings, she related it to the components or the dimensions of sense of coherence. So I will just follow that same, the same way that she did it. So with comprehensibility, all the children spoke about school as a safe and predictable place for them. They felt safe. They felt they belonged in spite of that diversity. Remember, 40 different countries that these kids came from in a relatively small school. There was complexity and conflict, and they knew that, they understood that there was complexity, but they still felt school was predictable and safe. And then it was very interesting because these rocky rules, in my next point there, they all felt those rules were necessary. And she said, and apparently it's a paraphrase, she hasn't used the school's real things, but she said this is roughly what it covers, okay? Look at the rules, remember to listen, own your actions, in other words, take responsibility. Care for others. Don't just think about yourself. Think about others too. Keep your hands to yourself so you don't violate other people's spaces or their belongings. Okay. And you can be a leader saying, you know, you've got potential. So all of these things, and apparently these are posted up around the school. So the kids are getting that message constantly, and it's so positive. But one very interesting finding was that, so these are youngsters, okay, grades 1 to 6. And they realized that they need adults to help them sort things out. The rules are there, and the adults, the teachers, help them to, you know, fulfill those rules. So although they did feel confidence at a certain level of dealing with it themselves, they also realized, the vast majority of them realized, they needed teachers at times. And then, well, maybe that's more of a manageability point. But anyway, so students sense that despite frustration and failure, things will work out. So this leading on from the previous point, the diversity, the complexity and conflict, it's there. It exists. It causes frustration. It causes failure sometimes. But don't worry. In the end, things work out. So at school, things are under control. And they were confident that the teachers would help them to solve conflicts. And it's very interesting, again, in the examples that she gives, because when they say circles are a safe place, they say you can tell the truth. So if you've done something wrong, or, you know, you did something without thinking and it impacted somebody else, you can say it. In a circle space, you can say it. you know, and they are taught as well, what is said in the circle stays in the circle. So it frees them up to talk about these things and to get it out, and it's sorted out into the classroom. It's sorted out within the classroom. It doesn't require them to go to the head teacher's office or something like that. And the meaningfulness side of things, students find school challenging. You know, if you think about never having been to school before and suddenly being in grade 3 or 4 and having to deal with that, it's very challenging, coming from a different cultural background and so on, but they feel engaged in decisions about processes that affect them. So they felt that, you know, if they were adamant, if a group of kids was adamant that something should not happen, they would be listened to, you know, because that it was going to affect them. They didn't want it to happen. They would be listened to. That's what they, the conclusion that they came for. And just to finish up, one of the things that really, really impressed me about this article as well, and this approach of the school, is that this was for everybody in the school. And what they were doing, although there were so many migrants and refugee kids in the school, they weren't just doing projects for the refugee kids. They were doing it so that the whole environment was learning these wonderful methods of conflict resolution and inclusion. And so in that way, the refugee kids were just included naturally as part of the process. It wasn't as if they were different and had to be, you know, specially included. So, right, that sort of sums up our two, well, we don't need to do this. It sums up our two case studies, really, that we want to think on a little bit more. And so now what I want us to think about, really, and just share examples of research and practice using a salutogenic approach, or very specifically the salutogenic model of health, or the sense of coherence, all the three components, and so on. And then secondly, to really think back to the learning outcome of the workshop. How can a salutogenic research or practice lead to positive outcomes for migrants and their host communities? And I think what I'll do is I will stop the share, and I'll copy that into the chat so that we can look at it just in our, wait, let me just find this. Sorry.
Are you looking for the chat or?
No, I'm just trying to go copy to the place where I can copy.
Okay.
So that I can put it into the chat.
Okay.
Yeah. But I can't get my cursor to work now.
You can't find it? Okay, let me see.
So, I mean, maybe what I should just do is write it in. How can salutogenic? I can just write it in.
Easy enough, yeah.
So, Fungi, do you want to maybe start? Or we haven't met Mariana, so maybe we can meet Mariana while I'm writing in chat.
Yes. Hi, Mariana. Mariana. Hi. Can you tell us, can you just introduce yourself a little? Okay. It's okay. You can also just introduce yourself by writing. We can all read it in the chat, just so we get a feeling of who you are. Okay, so are you you're a teacher? Ah, sounds really interesting. We would love to hear more about it. So I guess one of the things that we were thinking about is, can you tell us a little bit about what you guys have been doing? Gesine, you touched a little bit on what you do.
I'm also shy, Mario.
Don't be shy. We are five. We are six people. I think the sixth one is not even really here. So we're really five. So there's no judgment at all. We're really just interested to know what other people are doing, and then to see how can we relate the way we work to these ideas that have been talked about in the last couple of days in the conference.
Maybe I can say something. The thing is, I relate, because now my master's thesis is more on prison, people living in prison, and
okay,
how they stress. And actually, it kind of made me think, now, okay, basically, it's also forced migration. I made a very short connection. But for me, the interesting thing was about expectations. That's what I took now from your presentation, because I was the like, futures. Coming to prison, you have a very specific expectation. You're forced to be there. And mostly, I would say the expectation is very bad. How does that influence your sense of coherence, and then how you manage actually your stress in while you're in there? So that's, for me, a new dimension is the wrong word now, but it's something I will think about now for my thesis. So that's what I took. In general, those dimensions, which I think, you both of you spoke about them. So I think the dimension, I have to look into them much more in terms for my research now, mm-hmm. which is more on prisons and not on migration itself, but I could still relate to it. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, do you think that it could make a difference to practice as well? So we were talking about both research and practice. So you said yes for your practice, mm-hmm. your research, mm-hmm. but could it make a difference for a prison intervention, do you think?
Yeah, but I'm
sorry now, because I was in your previous workshop. So
you're thinking about specific resistance resources.
About specific resistance resources, but nevertheless, I think for interventions, prisons could really invest in those specific resistance resources and then kind of support prisoners to develop maybe long-term sense of coherence, like develop in their dimension, so that in future, even after release, they can maybe manage stress better than before. So in that way, that was what I was thinking, but in practices for my maybe health promotion, which I'm usually working in before, I wonder, I've never thought about it. So that's why I'm happy. So this workshop I attended more because it's what I did before, not because of my research. So I think it's good to integrate that in our health promotion strategies, to think about those as the dimensions. For me, this feeling, this meaningfulness is for me always.
Meaningfulness, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest, like having understanding why you're doing something and that it has an impact on what you want. Like this dimension for me becomes more and more important also for health promotion, because then once you understand the meaningfulness or you feel it, you might be able to change something.
That's great. Well, I mean, you're obviously going to think about your studies very differently after this conference, I think.
That's really interesting. I think the prison work is, although we're talking about migration here, but so you get migrants in prison, so
you do,
you know, they could be coming
disproportionately
with different expectations of prison as well from their home countries, so they may have a higher sense of coherence
culture, even for people from the same culture. But the prison, I see it sometimes as and their own culture, right? Where we have dynamics and standards.
Hierarchies and all that. So I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. We had a student here who did a study on women in prison. Mm-hmm. This was about 6 or 7 years ago. And there was a program that they could attend while they were in prison, but it was to help them integrate when they came out. Mm-hmm. So it got them thinking about, you know, relationships. It got them thinking about managing. Many of them had a drug problem as well, you know, and that was their social circle. It was the other drug users or whatever. So it got them thinking about, you know, and preparing. How are you going to manage once you get out of prison? Because if you know that going with those people leads you to taking drugs again, you need to now start thinking about what resources can you use, you know, outside and so on. So, and it did use salutogenesis, actually. I think the thesis used salutogenesis and in pretty thinking cool. about that. Yeah. So it is very interesting. And I mean, I think women prisoners in Norway are mostly Norwegian, whereas male prisoners are disproportionately immigrants. So it is interesting. So good luck with that.
I have one more idea, sorry, because you mentioned before those community gardens in Denmark, like
yes,
very briefly, right? So and then it was you said something like, yeah, it's because they often have traumatic experiences, and then doing the community garden they feel like
so what happened was that many people many immigrants think that if you do therapy you're mad. So it's very stigmatized. They don't think that you can just go and talk to a psychologist because you traumatized and you upset about something. They think you must be mad if you go to a therapist. So they don't want to go to therapists, but they have been so traumatized by bombs falling on them, by running, by seeing their loved ones shot in front of them, you know, whatever it is. And so in the study in Denmark, what they did was they got people working in an eco-village. Okay, so they were teaching them horticultural skills, how to plant, how to weed, how to water plants, you know, how to grow things and how to do it organically and so on. So on one level, they were learning skills that could be useful to them in the future. But what was so important to these people was that they were treated with respect. The other people in the eco-village spoke to them as equals. You know, and to them, they hadn't expected that. They thought, oh, we're just going to go and learn a job. This is training. We the underdogs again. You know, but they were treated with respect. And that was what one of the things, and besides being out in nature, okay, besides being out and working with plants and things, that was also one of the things that brought about healing. So that was really what I meant
I find it very logical, because when doing my work, I had traumatic experiences, and we get counseling, and they were always telling me, okay, now you had this traumatic experience, you need to do something creative or with your hands to calm down your hormones or to And I was like, okay, that's exactly what they're doing with that project, basically. So they said you should do pottery. I was like, oh, I don't want to do pottery. It's just an example, but I think it really helps you to concentrate, to use your hands and to calm down. But that's for trauma. But I was thinking with those people in this project, because that's what I learned recently. It's like often it's not trauma. We always say they have trauma, but often grieving because they lost their home, like they lost contact with family. And it's trauma and grieving is something different. And I wonder then for grieving, but maybe even in a garden, maybe it's nice for grieving. I don't know. I was just.
Yes. I can send you that if you like.
Would
you be interested in that article?
Of course.
Okay, I could send that to you. I've got your email address, so that's okay. Yeah, I'll do it after this. I'm not a multitasker when it comes to digital stuff. Yeah. And Nancy, have you had any thoughts about your research and how it relates?
Oh, thanks so much for sharing all of this research. So yeah, so first I should really admit that the entire concept is really, really new to me. So as I said, my research basically is on leisure and well-being. So my research basically take a lens using the positive psychology or social psychology view to see like how leisure participation can influence people's, like contribute to people's subjective well-being. So, but I'm also very interested in several concepts related to like people's like meaning of life, meaning and purpose in life and all of those stuff. So I can see there are some connections. Maybe if I'm wrong, correct me. So if the meaningfulness has some plays an aspect in the sense of coherence, this concept in this concept. So I think that's some aspect I'm very interested to know more. And actually when I was listening to your presentation, so like you shared two different research, that's being like reviewed in your systematic review. So one is about migrants in the Netherlands. Another one is in Canada. So I actually have some questions about those two papers, but I'm not sure if it is fair for me to ask them here because I know.
You can try and we can see if we can answer. If we remember, I've got the paper here somewhere.
I'll just share one of the questions I do have. So I also do some qualitative research work, and when I heard like Fungi, you sharing about the research about qualitative interviewing with people, one group has high like the high level of the sense of coherence, and the one is the low level of source of sense of coherence. Mm-hmm. And I heard that the interviewer would say, okay, you're in the low sense of coherence group. Then
she didn't say that.
I'm just curious.
I think they just did. You know, when they were analyzing it, they just knew who was who.
Okay,
and probably matched the the scores with the interview. So they would have them in one group and have, and then look at them to see what was happening there. But they didn't tell them. No, I think that would not be ethical.
Yeah. That's also what I was thinking.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering. Yeah, because in my research, I also try to understand why people have like the savoring. So one of the concepts I'm very interested in savoring. So savoring basically means those like positive emotion regulation or how you're appreciating those positive experiences. Mm-hmm. So I see people have high savoring ability as well as there's people have low savoring ability. So I was just trying to understand why people have such a gap in terms of their different savoring capacity. So mm-hmm. yeah, so that's why when I was heard, oh, someone is doing this, mm-hmm. I think maybe this is not quite good. If I say you're having low savoring, no. I wouldn't do that, but I'm just curious how the author is doing. But I guess I got it. So it's there's the stats, like the statistics first, and then they can like separate the groups and then do the interview, I guess. I got that.
It's quite a holistic approach to this study. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's interesting because they wrote another paper mm-hmm. that we also review in our chapter. Mm-hmm. And this paper is called Narratives of Meaningful Endurance mm-hmm. And How Migrant Women Escape the Vicious Cycle Between Health Problems and Unemployment. And what they do is they look also at this narrative method and a forgotten narrative typology. Mm-hmm. And then they have, and they name these two kinds, narratives of meaningful endurance or mm-hmm. narratives of non-directional distress. Mm-hmm. So it's a different way of analyzing it. Mm-hmm. And in that paper, they say that they also included Dutch women, not just yeah. these immigrant women. And there in that paper, they say that they did the sense of coherence 13 measure after the interviews. So they did it at the end of the interviews. They didn't do it before the interviews. They did it afterwards, mm. which is interesting. Interesting. Mm. Yeah, so it's definitely not going to, they weren't saying you've got a low one. And they still had to go and analyze them before they knew whether it was high or low.
Exactly.
So, right. So yeah, that was done. But it's the same group of people. Mm-hmm. And again, very interesting. So this meaningfulness thing, you know, and what Fungi was saying about what they said in their in the first paper about Antonovsky's construct of what makes meaningfulness and what makes comprehensibility and so on is different for these women that they were dealing with. So this idea of narratives of meaningful endurance, mm-hmm. you know, that they could see there was goodness, they were gaining something. And this is also what Antonovsky says, that the problem is, or that the stress is worth engaging with. You're going to get something out of it at the end, you know, and that's really important in this understanding of meaningfulness. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, I don't know if that relates to what you've been doing with meaning and purpose, Nancy.
Yeah.
It's
worth engaging in a problem.
Yeah. So like it's worth engaging. The meaningfulness, basically a lot of times I refer to the literature related to Sturger. The last name is Sturger, like S-T-E-G-E-R.
Oh, okay, the okay. name.
Okay. I did the name, sorry about yeah. it. So, yeah. Mm. So basically the meaningfulness would include things like connectedness, mm-hmm. Meaning, and what's the other aspect? Autonomy, maybe, something mm-hmm. related to that. So, yeah. Maybe it's a little bit different. I am not sure, but I'm happy to.
There's overlap. Yeah,
there's overlap. I see the overlap there. Mm. Yeah.
And I think this Lucius article would be interesting for you because of the way they're trying to operationalize when they're looking at consistency, load balance, and decision making power. It sounds like there might be some parallels there. So I think mm-hmm. it definitely would be interesting. And it's, you know, sometimes you read about these concepts when you just read a theoretical paper, but it's good to read how it's applied with examples and then go back again. Uh-huh. So they might be interesting articles for you to look at.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Nancy, if you put your email address in the chat,
sure.
we can send you the PowerPoint because it's got the two references in it. You know, then you could look up those references mm-hmm. yourself if you like.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, well, that's easy.
Yeah, straightforward.
I like that one. Okay, so are you now in the Netherlands? Is NL Netherlands?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm now in the Netherlands. Yeah.
My goodness. You get around Canada and Netherlands.
And the largest surprise to see that the paper that you share, one is in Canada, Alberta, and another one is in the Netherlands.
I know, right? Places where you're
highly relevant.
Marianne.
Yes, Marianne, like send us your email and I'll send you the PowerPoint as well.
Yeah, then you can read the articles and that should give you a good idea.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to ask about or share, Mariana?
Especially since you're working in schools and the article, you know, the practice article that we presented was actually to do with schools. So it might be interesting.
.cat, so Catalonia.
She says it's nice to listen to us talking. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. We'll let you off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Fungi, have you got any other insights to come up with here?
Gosh, I don't think so. It's just been nice. I mean, it's been a very small group, but it's kind of nice getting the different perspectives and not necessarily focusing on migrants, but also focusing on this idea of solutions. Oh, there's a new person showing up.
I have an example which is not migration related.
No, please, just
I'm thinking about meaningfulness or manageability, not
manageability.
Mm-hmm. I was on this project in Swaziland or Eswatini, how is it called?
Yeah.
They were introducing oral self-test during that time and doing also a study on that and a qualitative study. Hmm. I remember this oral self-testing. Okay, it was So in the qualitative study, it came out that some people or some respondents, they were actually using it to disclose their status to their partner, which is, of course is not the initial idea of oral testing, but they used the test as a resource for something else which they could manage, because then they would say, okay, I take two of those tests at home and you do it together, and then he thinks or she thinks I'm opening up to her in this moment, and even though I knew it already a long time. But I found interesting how that test, which is the prevention was used to manage, I don't know.
that's really interesting. Is that HIV we're talking about?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So not for the purpose it was set up for, but as a way of communicating, because it was so difficult to communicate openly. So they found, they used the test.
But there I see this for Solitude, it's basically the dimensions, they are much more approachable for this person in that moment, you know, to use this, they manage it. They are not forced to tell them, but they can manage time. I find that interesting now to look with the Solitude.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, you know, I also think I've also done a lot of work, and both and Fungi too, in the HIV field before we moved
into migration.
Yeah. And I mean, another aspect, and this is also where I think maybe Antonovsky doesn't capture every culture as well, is a collective culture, you know, and the way of dealing with things in a collectivity, as opposed to, you know, this Ubuntu idea, I am because we are, you know, so how do you tell people in a good way? How do you tell them something, you know, that is very difficult to tell? And I did a lot of my work in Botswana. And the president of the country, when I was at the time when I was doing my research, was a guy called Mohai. And I've heard him speak on various occasions to smaller groups, not, you know, as president. And he told this incredible story about at the beginning of, well, not at the beginning, but in 1999 or 2000, two students from Botswana were studying medicine in the United States. And the United States didn't let people enter the country if they were HIV positive. So in the United States, it was discovered that they were HIV positive. And they refused to let them fly back on commercial airlines. And they forced Botswana to send a plane to fetch these two students. And Mohai said, that cost the country the equivalent of a primary school. They, with the money that they spent fetching these two students in the presidential jet, you know, it wasn't a huge Boeing or something, but they could have built a primary school. That's what it cost the country. And then he said, what we're going to do now is the entire, you have to opt out of the test. You will automatically be tested if you are, you know, going for antenatal classes or you're doing any of these things, but you can choose to opt out. You've got the right to opt out. The human rights people were up in arms, you know, and he said, but it's our whole country. If people can't acknowledge that they are HIV positive or whatever, and it costs our country a primary school, you know, this is not right. We've got to start looking at it. And I mean, it's a different perspective. It's very hard for us maybe to understand, very hard, but we need to see there are different ways of looking at things. And I think also that's perhaps what the different ways of seeing what is predictable or what is, you know, consistent. The different ways of seeing, you know, like, I mean, I don't think autonomy is such a big deal in a collective society, because you've got to do things that are for the society, not for yourself, you know, and you don't make decisions. I know when I've interviewed people in Africa, I usually end up with three, not an individual interview, but I'm interviewing three. And they say, you know, because I want to make sure I'm representing the community when I'm saying things, or if you say something to me, I want to take it back correctly and I need somebody to do that with me. They don't want to come alone. It's a very different way of seeing things. So I also wonder if these three aspects, you know, comprehensibility, manageability and meaningfulness are different in different societies. You know,
I think so. And when you talk about collectivity, there's, I think it's Shifra who's worked on a sense of community coherence, which I think is interesting and I think would be maybe more relevant in our context, is to look at it more from that, you know, seeing that comprehensibility within your environment. How do you, as and relating to each other, and this issue of relating, because I really agree with you, Marguerite. I really don't agree that it quite captures every context, because it can't. Because it was, although it's been tested all around, but it's been tested from a very specific viewpoint. So I think it's a very important point that you make. And I think it's something that we have to consider when we go into different contexts, or when we're working with people from different contexts within our own contexts. We have to take this rather than just, you know, brush them off and say, well, you've got a low sense of coherence. Maybe they don't, you know, because as you said, the SOC 13 and the SOC 20, what are they capturing? So I think we always have to go back to that. Who has developed it? Who was it developed for? And is it really appropriate for the people that we're talking to? So I think it's great that they did have the in-depth interviews as well. And like what we found for our article, right, a lot of it was quant, you know, big quantitative studies.
Although it has to be said that not that I'm a quant researcher, but the construction of the SOC 29 and 13 uses what is called facet theory, and that is phenomenally complex. You know, it really does take into, so although they're only 13 questions, they cover I don't know how many facets. That is incredibly clever way of questioning. So I think there's something to be gained from it, but
definitely, but not everything. I think we always have to have the question mark to say, okay, it's given me quite a good overview, but is there more, or what does it actually mean?
And the way Slurchers and them say, let's develop, see what else goes into this dimension. You know, it's not just, you know, socially valued decision making. It's there's more to it than that.
So it really gets the brain going.
Yeah. Elizabeth, you've just joined us. How are you?
Welcome.
Silence. Okay.
No, there she comes.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Sorry. But now I with my children, so I cannot talk because of the micro. Maybe you can listen children shying or something.
Okay.
So I prefer to just listen and maybe chat something.
Okay.
Yes, you can
see it. All right. Oh, there they are.
That's nice.
And on the other side, I have two more children, so I'm a little bit busy.
You're busy.
Yes.
Oh,
okay, but just tell us quickly, what are you researching with or working with?
But I'm from Deep Salut. I'm working in Deep Salut, you know, health policies.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And yes, I'm interested in this the immigration, because also I used to work with young people from different countries. Mm. So it's for that I'm listening here today.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Well, I think if you put your email in the thing, I can send you the presentation, because I think you missed the presentation. And I'll send that to you. And then you can read the two articles we were talking about.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
Sure.
Yeah. 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 And hopefully they can read our chapter when it comes out.
Yes.
End of the year.
I was just thinking again how traumatizing alone it is to come from a collective culture then to something like Norway, and then to be in, I don't know how it works in Norway, how they live when they arrive, but then to cope on that moment without this community sense,
It is difficult. They're put into asylum centers depending on the age. So you have the ones for adults if you're, and I think the, is it 16? No, 14 plus go into the adult ones. Mm-hmm. And then the younger ones go into either foster care, or they go into the special children's units until they get their permission. And then they are put into central municipality, and then they are given housing from that municipality. But of course, you also have the freedom to find your own housing. But then you lose some benefits, right? Was it you lose some benefits if you find your own housing, or it has to be within a certain price or something like that? But some people have done that and showing, you know, high sense of coherence and agency, and have just thought, I'm sitting here waiting to be put into housing, and I'm just going to go and find my own housing, because everything takes time. So that's how the system
is. And that's interesting, because then they often do it as a group to go and find housing together. You know, that's what Sabib did, for example. She went in with a group of three women. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it like in the Netherlands then? There's much more independence.
I'm in the Netherlands, but I'm from Germany, so I don't really
know. Oh, yeah.
In Germany?
You know, in Germany, to be honest. I haven't been working.
Yeah, because you've been working outside. You've been working outside, right? You've been working all over the world.
But not really back home. So this is
even
with the prisons now, it's researching back home because of the pandemic a little bit.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. But in Germany, it's asylum centers as well. And then you need the language. I'm not sure how that is in Norway, but the language is so important. They have to pass certain tests before they can get certain benefits. So that's quite.
Oh, okay. We don't do that. They have what they call an introduction course, where you learn language and the, you know, social society, what Norwegian society is like, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then they get an allowance while they go through this program. So they will be living already somewhere outside. And then they have to do this over 2 years, but it's changed now, right? They've now changed it they've now made it more flexible, so that if you're really quick and you pick everything quickly, you know, you can do it quick and you can leave quicker. And they've made it longer for those that maybe come in with no education, and then everything is going to take so much longer. So they have more time. But the only thing is that I think they cut if you don't attend classes, or if you don't fulfill it, you may lose benefits.
Well, what I think the thing was that they realized that many people coming into Norway didn't have the same work day as we have in Norway. You're supposed to work sort of half past 8 to half past 4. And so they made the program between half past 8 and half past 4. And if you were regularly late, your allowance got cut. Yeah. You know, you would get a warning. But the idea was to teach people, if you're going to get a job in Norway, you need to be punctual, and you need to be, because different people have different concepts of time.
Punctuality.
Yeah. So I think there's a reason behind it.
It's a training. I think they're generally quite generous and quite good, and you will get quite a lot of warnings. And I find Norway generally, if you explain things, there's always some understanding. There's a lot of leeway in Norway, which I think you don't find in many other countries. We can criticize, but I think really when we look at the system here, it's a kinder system in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's very generous in the amount of money people get. Mm. It's about, is it 19,000 euros a year or something? So, which is pretty generous. I think. Yeah, is that right? 190,000 krona a year?
Yeah, that's,
or around 200,
that's,
yeah,
about 19,000 euros.
19,000 euros a year, yeah. So yeah, it's and to learn the Norwegian system and just ways of doing things and yeah.
And so to what be flexible. Would you recommend for our practices with migration populations then, if we look at it from a salutogenic, I can never
genic.
So the question is, what would we recommend for?
What is important for you to integrate in practices? And like I'm taking home now is I'm thinking of this collective, and I'm taking this one, even though it was not really your part of it. But then having interventions which are maybe more approaching groups of people and those that they feel like a family, and like I'm wondering how to implement things like this. Not if you have any recommendations.
Well, I mean, I do think, you know, the school one, which approached the whole society of the school together, I think we need something like that in Norwegian society, because we do expect refugees to come in and become little Norwegians.
Yes.
You know, we want them to assimilate. When I say we, not Fungi and me, but the general society expects them to become little Norwegians, to like going hiking in the mountains and to like doing all the same things that Norwegians do. Mm-hmm. So there's not a really, in the society, we're not dialoguing to hear, what are the things you're enjoying? Well, let me try and do that with you and see if I enjoy it.
Exactly.
Or, you know, we're not building those relationships, which I think showed up really well in that article. You know, that this is just the school, everybody does this, and you just, you know, everybody's part of it. It's inclusive. Mm-hmm. So we're inclusive, but on our terms in Norway, I think. And,
definitely,
you know, the host society isn't really learning or isn't really listening, maybe.
Things are done. Why do you said before, I think also in the school example, that they ask the children, why do you do it? What is
exactly?
Yes. What are your thoughts? Yeah. What were your thoughts when you did it?
Exactly. Yeah. What were your thoughts when you didn't show up for the introduction program at 8 o'clock? But I think I agree with Marguerite. And also this issue, like, this is how we work. We work very participatory and have a very bottom up approach. So this issue of listening, you can't just, there's the thing about imposing a lot of things on people, but it's asking, what do you need? What do you need so that we can, you know, what do you need? What can help you so that we can develop programs or interventions or whatever that are appropriate for your needs, rather than thinking, we need you to get a job, we need you to do this, we need you to, I mean, this is the thing about people living in the diaspora, people having families back home. And you're thinking, okay, I'm going to migrate, right? I've left my mother and my 7 brothers and sisters who need to be put in school. I need to get a job. And you're wondering, why is this person not showing up? Because they're doing bits and pieces all over the place. But so you need to understand, you know, what is the person's reality? And of course, you cannot adapt to everybody's reality, but you can have a general idea of, okay, this is what is needed. And this is where we need to start. Instead of starting from where we think, what we think is important. That's when programs simply don't work. And then there's so much frustration, and then there's blaming. Oh, these lazy immigrants, they don't want to, they just want to sit at home. But it's not that, it's just that it doesn't make sense to them. There is no comprehensibility, there's no meaningfulness to it. So that sense of coherence comes in very nicely here, actually. Can we make coherent, you know, and programs and processes? Yes, Elizabeth, I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, yeah, here in Spain, we have a big problem, you know, with the young people is coming from Africa alone. There are minors. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's a very important problem here in Catalonia and Spain.
Yeah.
So also, I think that the administration, the public administration, don't know exactly how to interact with them and how to understand. And sometimes people or the educators do something, but without listening and without... and want to understand really what the way that children are doing. So I'm thinking it is a challenge, no, how to do it with them, no, with these young people.
Yeah.
And maybe
on the other hand, it's a chance because they are young, they can develop.
Exactly.
There's so much to do good and wrong.
It's an opportunity. And I think we've had the same problem here in Norway, and they've tried different things. And I don't know what the system is there, where they've been in institutions or in fostering, and you find that the ones that are in foster homes, you know, foster homes where they stay with a family, they do much better than the ones who are in an institution with maybe one person or people coming in shifts, right? And then it depends on the personality. Someone is really good, someone is really, it's just a job, I'm just gonna come and sit here and watch you guys. So that's something that we've seen from some of the research that we've done, just the difference between, you know, being in a family environment where you're really living and learning the culture, the language, you're having that care, versus being put in with a whole lot, or being in a room by yourself, in a little flat by yourself. So sometimes those approaches as well, but of course that is all about resources and access and stuff like that. But I think you can still develop family-like environments.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but we have to finish up now so that people can go back to the final plenary. But I will send all these things to everybody that I mentioned here. Mm-hmm. I'll send a group email out to you all. And thank you so much for participating and engaging with us and for this really, really interesting discussion. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
It's lovely. Small and intimate. Good.
I know, it's very intimate. I'm sorry, Elizabeth, that you came in late and missed some of the earlier. Yeah, I think you probably had some interesting stuff. Yeah, children.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Lovely to meet you all. Thank you very much.
Really lovely. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.